Accession number 17429, Reel 3.
Mr. Burrows, Reel 3.
Having got to the police station, I reported to the senior officer and explained the situation, that the platoon was on patrol, but I could muster a few men if I could be of any assistance. He thought this was a bit pointless because all his reserve forces were pulled in and he was worried about the safety of the college itself. So he thought it better that the few troops I could muster remained on guard duties. I then suggested that I seek out the patrol where they've been dropped off. I drive there and fire several bursts in the air. I thought this would be a good idea because it would obviously attract the platoon to come and investigate. He declined this and thought it was just confused the situation. I thought it was a good idea. He decided otherwise. It was at this point he glanced out the window and saw my scout car there, complete with the twin Brens. He said he'd mustered a squad of police who at that time were beginning to climb into the open back semi-armoured vehicle. This was it had armoured plating around the sides, but it was quite open. Thought it'd be a good idea if I could follow up behind to give them cover, and when they'd done the sweep through the Kalum rubber estate, I could cover them if necessary. Well, I followed them along the initially the main road and then into the rubber estate along the winding one track roads. Now, this was always dangerous because it was a trick of the terrorists to lure security forces into ambush after creating a situation, an incident. So I decided that to keep very close to, in order to bring my guns to bear if need be. Probably not the regulation spacing, but fairly close. I thought this was the best thing to do. A grenade lobbed in would have killed the police, or even a burst of fire. I felt sorry for them, the way they had to travel around. And the police really bore the brunt of many ambushes. Ill-trained, ill-underpaid. However, we got to the rubber estate offices and the police debussed and moved out on foot, leaving their vehicle in the compound. I followed slowly behind as they moved along the track, and then they moved into the estate and started to clear it. I was able to keep fairly level and traverse my guns from side to side. Bearing in mind the a point in the scout car itself, it had twin Bren guns, but these were mounted above the vehicle, and to operate them you had to sit inside and operate the triggers via something that looked very much like a bicycle handlebars with brakes on. You'd press the brakes, they'd operate the triggers. You couldn't sight the weapons, but you could traverse them in a direction. There was no way you could sight, but you could fire within an arc. Each magazine had 100 rounds, so it was quite an awesome firepower you could put down if it's the right spot. So, having moved along the track, I stopped the car and they moved into the rubber, and I covered them as they moved up and sat there for a while, and I thought, well, we're presenting a lovely target here for the CTs that might be lurking around. two brain guns, a couple of submachine guns, the driver and myself, a supply of grenades, everything. So I decided that we would just drive up and down the road, keeping fairly near to where the police had, were doing their sweep. They were out of sight, incidentally, so there was very little support we could give them. Eventually, I came back to near the point where they dropped off, and a party came down the hill from the rubber carrying the dead manager, European manager, on a sheet of corrugated iron. And they placed him on top of the bonnet of the scout car, and so they were returning to pick up his escort, police constable. Well, this guy was laying on the bonnet, and I was looking down at him, and he'd been shot several times. I was rather sickened to see that several of his fingers were severed, and his belt ammunition was shot up. I was surprised they hadn't taken several magazines he had on his belt, which seemed to be intact. He was a young guy, probably in his early 30s. Well, I couldn't resume the patrolling, driving along the track with his body on the bonnet. So I waited and kept traversing the weapons around, the guns in each direction. Then, after 15 minutes or so, the carrying party returned with the sheet of corrugated iron with the dead Malay police constable. Now, the terrorist had brutishly killed this guy. His head was shot away. The police had covered what was left of it with large banana type leaves. They then returned to the compound on foot, and I followed close behind, and leaving a party behind with the bodies, the police vehicle returned and the bodies were lifted on, and I believe they were returned to the estate offices for eventual removal, hospital, mortuary, and we returned to Tang Yong Malin. I went back to the base in the gymnasium in the college, and after no more than 10 minutes, another scout car and Jeep Land Rover pulled up, and it was a major from our own regiment, the Royal West Kents, and he asked me where the platoon was, and I explained they were on patrol, and I was left in charge. I reported what had happened during the day, the murder of the planter and his escort. He didn't seem particularly interested, which surprised me. I thought we'd mount follow-up operations and seek these so-and-sos out. But he said there'd been a major incident and all other operations were suspended. I was to go as quickly as I could to the RV pickup. Although it was early, there was a chance that maybe the platoon had returned a bit early and be waiting for the transport. This is what happened, in fact. I got to the RV pickup point and the platoon was already there. I reported to the platoon commander and said I was to give him a message from the major that Operation Daffodil was effective. This meant nothing to me, but I was later to learn Operation Daffodil was a major operation mounted to follow up the ambush at Ulu Yam, where the Royal West Kents suffered 60% death and a 40% wounded. Every man was a casualty, 60% killed. the numbers were probably, without referring to reference, it's probably about 15 West Kents killed, 4 Ebon trackers killed, and the rest were wounded. They put up a heroic fight, and I was not there, of course. They put up a heroic fight and they beat off several communist rushes to finish off the West Kents and acquire their weapons. Quite a prize for them, really. There was 5 Bren guns on this patrol, a worthwhile hole for the enemy.
Did they get them?
No. The idea was to get all the platoon weapons, as I say, 5 Bren guns, numerous submachine guns, rifles, grenades, the lot. They'd killed the officer and the platoon sergeant in the first burst of fire. The convoy moving through the estate after they were picked up after completion of their operations was a small type 1500 vehicle, the standard army 3-tonner vehicle, and a scout car much the same as the one I'd been using before. The enemy had some sort of old Japanese weapon. It was assumed, you might call it an anti-tank gun, and they knocked out the scout car traversing mechanism of the Brens, and it was unable to bring the guns to bear. This was a heroic action. There was a lance corporal left wounded, and he rallied the men as best as he could, and eventually he was wounded again. A private soldier, I'm leaving names out of my discussions at this point, became the hero of the day, and he rallied the men. I believe he was wounded 3 or 4 times, and they fought off the CTs, and eventually they withdrew, leaving 6 of their own dead and their own weapons behind. Later the lance corporal was to receive the military medal, and the private soldier the DCM, Distinguished Conduct Medal. And that was the blackest day of the West Kents in Malaya. I myself was involved in the follow-up operations leading my section. We got to the ambush site, which was probably about 20 miles from our location. The vehicles were still there, shot up and bloodstained. The bodies had been removed. We followed up and swept the area and laid ambushes all night and the following day. We didn't make any contact with the enemy. I gather a few days later, several CTs were killed in ambushes. They may have been the ones responsible, or they may have been just another force.
Did it much affect the morale of the unit?
Very much so. The problem in Malaya at that time was, on patrol, was boredom. Nothing ever really happened. It is said that 2,000 man hours of jungle bashing to make a contact with the enemy or a kill, and that's how it was. Days, weeks, you wouldn't see anybody, you would not see a sign of the enemy. Another time you'd find a deserted camp, or you'd rush into a camp and they went out the other end. You might fire a quick burst at a fleeting target, and that was it. You were lucky if you made a kill. I think we done a good job by keeping them on the move. We moved them away from the areas where they could do the most damage, i.e. the towns, the villages. Eventually moved back into deep jungle. They split their company and platoon strengths into smaller groups, operated as sections, and they were on the defensive in 1950-51. The early days they were on the offensive, and in fact I understand that they had the communist flag flying in a particular village. I can't remember the name, others would. Their policy was to terrorize the community, to disrupt the economy, and gradually make different towns, states into a communist domain. They didn't succeed. Another particular incident whilst based at Tanjung Malin, we went out on a patrol at so-called platoon strength, i.e. two sections, one section leading, two section behind. I was bringing up the section behind, and we're moving through this particular jungle area when I've got a hand signal back. Everything was hand signals, we didn't shout commands, we had to be silent if we could. The signal was what we called an ambush signal, which was a hand across the face, as if one was grasping your face. This indicated immediate ambush. Another signal would be like two hands held above the head, which meant basher or bandit camp. The signal came back, I was bringing up the last section, and the signal I thought I got was the immediate ambush, and everybody went to ground, and I cocked my Owen gun. Now this is a point worth making. Now, the Owen gun was an Australian weapon, a superior version of the British Sten gun. It had a kind of a hair trigger, and if you cocked it, it was liable to go off, and it worried the life out of me at times. And although it is normal to have your weapon cocked, usually with a safety catch on, this was cocked, and there was a slide that prevented the working parts going forward. Well, when I got this signal, which I assumed to be immediate ambush, I pushed the slide over, the working parts went forward and fired off a round. Well, there was deadly silence. The platoon commander yelled back, "Who fired that bloody shot?" Well, imagine my embarrassment when I said, "I did, sir." Well, we moved forward and the birds had flown. There was a small encampment, just one hut, basher, lean-to type, which housed probably four or five men. They'd gone. My shot had caused them to bolt, and they got away. Now we thought these were probably a small assassination squad that would go down and knock off the odd informant. So that wasn't a very successful operation. There was another time when we were back at our company headquarters in Trolak. I was ordered to go to Petonia headquarters with some documentation, and I got into the scout car and was driving along this some 40 miles with the driver. I was manning the twin Brens, and after a few miles a couple of shots bounced off the scout car. I'd obviously been sniped at. Well, I was feeling a bit cocky, I think. I was sitting up there with my blue beret on and taking in the scenery and probably asking for trouble. Well, I remember getting to battalion headquarters, and the drill was to stop just outside the gate and remove the magazines from the weapons and clear the working parts, which I did. But unfortunately, I'd done this just a little inside the compound. And the vehicle drove in and parked in the MT yard, and I went over to battalion headquarters with this documentation when I was confronted by the RSM, who gave me a right rollicking for cocking the weapons and not being very soldiery and everything else. I was in my jungle greens with jungle boots. I had my Owen gun slung over my shoulder. I was a bit mucky and I had my blue beret on, but after all, I'd been on operations, whereas they tended to play a little bit more regimental in battalion headquarters. They had drill parades and they wore white belts and gaiters and things like that. With the headquarters group, and the RSM was more keen on playing traditional soldiers than getting on with the business of hunting down the enemy. I had several clashes with this gentleman. I might say that he was an ex-member of the Welsh Guards, which is probably enough in itself to say he was a disciplinarian. Well, as time went by, I had another clash with him when I'd had a particularly nasty lot of sores, jungle ulcers, boils, and I needed to spend some time in the casualty reception area in the base at Kuala Kuburu. Well, the way of clearing up some of these sores we had was to paint your legs with different colours, a green dye and a blue dye, and you look more like a red Indian with war paint on. Well, the RSM was always looking for the NCOs to carry out regimental duties when they're in base, and I was basically fit for medicine and duties. And he collared me to do a guard mounting exercise. Well, I wasn't very popular when I turned up in my shorts with my legs painted green and wearing slippers, whereas I should have been dressed up in white gaiters, belt, and carrying a cane. And I didn't get on with this gentleman. This is some of the regimental side of the Royal West Kents.
Why were you wearing a blue beret?
Oh, we tend to wear soft berets, unless you're in the jungle. After I was going to battalion headquarters to report, you know, lots of marching up and down saluting kind of thing. You wouldn't normally wear your floppy jungle hat in the battalion headquarters. You try to look a bit regimental. Although you wore your jungle greens and your belt, equipment, ammunition, water bottle, bayonet if you were carrying one, you tend to put your berry on to be a little smarter.
About how long were you there on operations then?
Well, I spent approximately a year in Malaya, and I would say 80% of this was, or even more than that, was operations all the time. I did get a 7-day break in Penang leave centre, which was, you know, quite a jolly time, relaxing, sunbathing, that kind of thing, wandering around the beaches, visiting temples, and generally getting drunk with two other colleagues. One of the other colleagues have joined the Malayan police service later and got killed in an ambush. So it was nearly all operations as far as I was concerned. I was in the latter part of my 5-year engagement in the army, and it was towards the end that the new Labour government imposed an additional 6 months on on all soldiers, national servicemen, regular soldiers. There was a lot going on. There was the Korean War, and the Mau Mau had started up in Kenya, and there was where the army is quite overstretched at that particular time. When I joined, we had soldiers to spare.
How did you like going out into the jungle? Did you like it, or did you dread it?
I can honestly say I enjoyed the jungle, and I wouldn't say I felt at home, but it was a great adventure. Although I was only a corporal most of the time, eventually I became a sergeant and then a colour sergeant. I enjoyed the jungle. I enjoyed being in command. I thought I was a bit of a strict disciplinarian. I had mainly national servicemen in my section. I usually had a command of about 14 men because, as I said earlier, we never had enough people to make up three sections, so we operated on two larger sections. And then invariably that would drop down because there'd always be a few sick. It couldn't go on operations. So I can honestly say I enjoyed it. My section probably consisted of 60% national servicemen and the rest regular soldiers. I was very disappointed in some of the people I had under my command, national servicemen. They were there and they didn't want to be there, and they couldn't accept it. Some did. Some became good soldiers and enjoyed it. Some got promoted, and of course there was always the national service second lieutenant. I thought this was an affront personally, to bring a boy out of about 18 and a half with a pip on his shoulder, whereas we had regular soldiers with years of experience, active service. Our platoon sergeant we initially had, but later got transferred and promoted and not replaced, won the military medal during the war. We had a very good regular platoon commander who was a Sandhurst man. He was a full lieutenant as opposed to the second lieutenant. He went on to gain a mention in dispatches and win the MC. Excellent soldier, excellent leader. I can't say enough for him. Coming back to the national servicemen, most of them were from London area. We had our own barrow boy. I don't want to say much about the personalities, but it's people I didn't really want to lead up the jungle, some of these. The others, first class. One of the national servicemen, I was probably pushing them too hard, but it was the strain was on the commando, irrespective of rank or command, to try and keep the guys alert. Nothing happened until the big West Kent massacre. Then people started to look and be more alert. But all these guys just didn't have the stamina. They didn't have the go. They didn't want to be in the army, and if they could skive, they would. Don't get me wrong, I'm only talking about a few. But a few was enough. A few was enough. The rotten apple, if you like. However, I had to be fairly tough. And one day,